Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning call and talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we'll be talking with attorney Margaret Bash. She is a practicing attorney and author of the book, Every Woman Should Go to Law School or Read This Book. The book is her account of the lessons in power that she has learned as operating as an attorney, and she has a number of things to pass on to women, and she says that women have a lot of catching up to do in the worldwide power department. We'll talk with her during this hour and take your calls as well. That's what the show is about. It's a conversational thing. You're invited. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, within the 217 area code, 333-WILL, and toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Margaret Bash, good morning. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, we got you there.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And I have to apologize. Cheryl Weedy, who you know, was going to be hosting the show, and I don't know if we passed on word about this, but she's hunting for a house in Milwaukee at the moment.
I heard that.
Yeah. So you got me. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's great.
And, of course, I'm neither a woman nor have I gone to law school, but I did read your book.
And?
And I thought it had a lot of good lessons for men as well.
Good, thanks.
But let me ask you to start... just to have you talk a little bit about what your intention is with the book in terms of what in general is the lesson that you want to pass on to women that you get through lawyering.
I have had a truly frustrating experience in the years that I've been an attorney with women who encounter problems, like they pay money to a contractor and never see him again. Mm-hmm. And it frustrates me to see women sit around and cry about it. You know, I gave the guy $500, poor me, I'm never going to see my $500 again. I don't think women appreciate all the resources that are available to them.
Mm-hmm. And you say that law school is a good place to get that kind of grounding. Is that...
What you get in law school is the ability to take the bar exam, which makes you, it empowers you in that if you pass the bar exam, you can make a phone call or write a letter and say, I'm a lawyer. And that gives you power.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily acquire all the skills and resources that are available to every woman when you're in law school. Basically, all you do in law school is read hundreds of cases and discuss what was the issue and what was the resolution. And I don't think most people know this, but you don't really learn in law school how to draft a lawsuit or how to answer one, how to take discovery or how to draft an order. I mean, those are things you learn on your own after you graduate from law school. And they're things that everybody can learn.
And these are skills that essentially have to do with personal power.
Well, I think so. I mean, if somebody takes your $500, instead of sitting around crying about, poor me, I lost $500, why not figure out how to get it back? Whether it's by filing a lawsuit, writing an action letter, turning them over to your state's attorney general if it's a consumer fraud issue. I mean, what I'm trying to get women to do is to say, okay, here is the problem, and here are my resources. And what's the best way to resolve the situation?
You say in the beginning of the book that women are not taught these ways of dealing with the world as men have been, and this is basically because we've lived in a very patriarchal society, and perhaps men pass down knowledge to their fathers to their sons, but there's been a different idea about the role of women and so forth, so they haven't been trained in those same ways.
I think that's true. Well, obviously it's true that traditionally men have had more societal power, and so they've learned certain tricks about how to maneuver in the system, and they've been able to pass those on to their sons. But because women never had power to speak of until recent generations, mothers couldn't pass those same things on to their daughters. And things like mentoring opportunities were always available to men, because those things existed in traditionally male professions. And now they're becoming available to women. I don't think women necessarily know how to maximize those opportunities.
Well, let me ask you to talk about your own experience. You graduated law school some years ago, I guess you've been practicing about 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah. And, I mean, you say that really your education as an effective lawyer began after law school.
I think that's true. I mean, I know you have U of I Law School there, and I don't want to get angry calls from professors, but it's true. You really don't learn anything important in law school. Now, you learn how to look up the law. That's pretty much all they can teach you because the law changes. I mean, it's constantly changing. New laws are being passed. New cases are being handed down. So all they can really teach you in law school is how to look up the law. You know, it would be pointless to say, okay, here's the law today, and by the time you graduate 3 years from now, it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. But there are other things in terms of negotiating, writing letters. I put some tricks in my book that I just sort of fell into that I think that women can use. Mm-hmm. Things like in my chapter on writing action letters, I talk about, you know, more than just threatening to sue someone in a letter. If you attach a copy of the lawsuit and say, here's a copy of the lawsuit that I'm going to file on Monday if I don't get my $500 back, they might pay more attention.
Certainly. Well, there are a number of areas where you offer pretty practical advice throughout the book. And it has to do with these sort of ways of negotiating and, you know, sort of holding your ground or, you know, doing the groundwork necessary to have a position that you can hold.
See, all of those things just make sense to me.
Yeah.
And I wrote the book because I understand it doesn't just come naturally to every woman, that before you go to buy a car, that you should appreciate this is something you do maybe every few years. You're going to be dealing with a person who sells cars day in and day out.
Right.
And you need to, before you even step foot in the showroom, do your research. Go to the library, read consumer reports, go on the internet and find out, you know, what the dealer's actual cost for different items on the vehicle are. Because otherwise you're going in there just basically with the sticker that they show you and trying to negotiate from that. And who do you think is going to be in the favorable position?
One of the things that, you know, just getting back to this issue of power that, you know, I wanted to sort of, you know, lay out at the beginning of the program is the equation of power that you say essentially power is a finite resource, and that one of the things that people have to realize is if you gain power, somebody else loses it, and that women have, you know, perhaps traditionally had a different attitude about this, and maybe that's one of the reasons that power has been such a difficult issue for women.
Actually, I think what I said in the book is that women have always understood somehow, even if they couldn't articulate it,
yeah,
that the amount of power in the world is finite, and particularly as it relates to them. Whereas men don't want to be bothered with the notion and don't want to know if power is finite or not. And the reason is, if one person gains power, then another person necessarily loses power, is scary in terms of your social conscience, if you have one. So that if you get more than your share of power, is somebody losing their share? And I think that women worry about that. You know, if two women are up for a promotion, each of them almost always will worry, oh, well, you know, if I get the promotion, or, you know, is Susie going to have her feelings hurt? Because, you know, maybe she thinks she's more deserving of it, and, you know, maybe she is. And if two men are up for a promotion, both men want the promotion. If the other guy's feelings are hurt, well, you know, that's how the system works. So men don't want to think of it in terms of, am I getting more than my share? Men have it instilled in them that their importance is based on how much power they have, whether they measure that by how much money they make or how many people report to them. Power is a good thing to men. And to women, it's a little more qualified than that.
It's interesting when you see this played out, and I was thinking of, there was a story recently about one of the, I forget which college, but, you know, sports has been reconfigured in various colleges so that gender equity is, you know, is more closely reached. And what this means in many cases is that a lot of the funding for the male teams has been reduced,
right,
to pay for the female athletes, you know, the programs for female athletes and different kinds of sports and so forth. And I believe there was a lawsuit where a group of men claimed that they were being discriminated against because their funding was being cut to pay for more funding for the female athletic programs. And it's always just very interesting to see how, you know, whereas previously maybe the guys got most of the equipment and the funding, and now they're claiming they're discriminated against because they're not getting most of it.
That's an interesting illustration. It makes the point, even though what you're really talking about is money.
Yeah.
But money is power in some circumstances. And like everything else, there's only so much of it to go around. And, you know, if you increase funding to women's programs at the expense of men's programs, you know, is that costing the men, and where is the balance? And obviously everybody wants what they're entitled to. The point is, though, that they're willing to fight for what they think they have coming, and that's an important issue. One of the things I talked about in my book is how women talk about things like, well, how come truck drivers make so much money and child care workers don't make much money? And I've been to, you know, seminars where women sit around and bemoan the fact that, you know, well, truck drivers have basically the same educational requirements and responsibility level. Well, the fact of the matter is men got together and formed the Teamsters Union. And they said, if you want to have bread and milk, you're going to have to pay us this amount of money, or you're not going to have bread and milk in your stores and on your tables. Women who are child care workers need to appreciate that they have that kind of power. You know, if you want to go to work on Monday morning and you want somebody to take care of your children, you're going to have to pay us this amount of money, or we're going to stay home, and you're going to stay home because you're not going to have anybody to take care of your children. It's not a matter of who has power available to them. It's a matter of who's willing to stake a claim to it.
Very interesting.
So, well, yeah. You know, there are all kinds of issues about who's entitled to what, but they're really irrelevant unless a group or a person is willing to say, this is what I'm entitled to, and this is the consequence if I don't get that.
Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with attorney Margaret Bash. She's the author of the book, Every Woman Should Go to Law School or Read This Book, recently published in paperback by HarperCollins. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Speaking of staking a claim and standing up for oneself, you relate a story in your own life about how after law school you found yourself in a position of, you know, starting your own business, and you were either going to sink or swim, and, you know, you had to pay the bills, so you had to do whatever you had to do to get yourself out there and get some business going. And the problem was that, you say, you'd always been a very shy person. And I think this is an issue that many of us deal with. And it's a barrier that you know, can really stop us from succeeding in whatever field we want to go into.
I know you don't have that problem, Jack.
Well, actually, I do. And just in the sense of, for example, you know, you talk about getting up and speaking in front of a group of people. It's one thing to sit here behind a microphone, you know, because I don't actually have to see anybody. You know, as far as I know, we're the only two people listening anyway. But it's another thing to get up in front of a large group of people who are all looking at you, and you're supposed to be the, you know, the entertainer or the speaker, or, you know, you got to talk for an hour. What are you going to do?
Right.
You know,
people
that's a pretty.
Know me now.
Yeah.
And maybe people who know you find it hard to believe that we're basically shy people.
Right.
You know, how can you get up and stand in front of a group of people? How can you go on the radio or television if you're shy? You know, how come you're not quaking in your boots? And, I mean, I was the extreme of shy all growing up. I mean, my only recollection of first grade was being picked to be Lucy in a Peanuts play instead of a haystack, which is what I really wanted to be, because the teacher thought it would make me project. And instead, I stood on stage and whispered, "Charlie Brown, you're a blockhead," because I just couldn't do it. And even in law school, every time the teacher would look down at the seating chart, I would put my head down and say, "Please, God, don't let him call on me," because I didn't want to stand and recite. And it wasn't that I didn't know the material. I was a shy person, and I just wanted to be educated and not have to participate. But the fact of the matter is that sometimes to put food on the table or to survive, you have to overcome that. And what I tried to do in the book is to give some tools that, you know, you don't need to go jump off the high dive if you're afraid of the water, that sometimes you can just put your toe in as a start. And for me, it was very gradual. I mean, I joined the Chamber of Commerce thinking, oh, this is a really good way for me to get business. But because I was so shy, I would go there and sort of stand by the buffet table and wait for people to talk to me. And I was in it almost a year and never really met anybody. And what you find out is it doesn't kill you to put your hand out and say, you know, "Hi, my name is Margaret, and, you know, I'm visiting or I'm new here or whatever." And after you do that a few times and nobody says, "Well, so," or you know, acts like you're bothering them or whatever, it gets easier. And then as you start meeting people, you know, people that you know introduce you to other people, and you find out it's not such a horrible experience, and it's something that can be overcome, the shyness thing.
Well, you also, you joined the Rotary Club, and that made things easier for you to meet people and start to feel like you were part of the scene.
Rotary was great for me. I mean, I feel like I have a chapter in my book that's a commercial for Rotary, and in a way it is. I mean, Rotary is a great organization. There are similar organizations. What I talk about is that it's important to have a network, that building a network is actually building a net for yourself in case you fall, that there's a net of people who are willing to catch you. And Rotary was particularly effective for me because Rotary is a service organization, and people in Rotary tend to be people who want to do service and help other people. And to me, that was a good place to build a network. Plus, I had some experiences in Rotary. For example, you have to give what's called a classification talk. You have to talk about what you do for a living for 20 minutes in front of people that by then you've been having lunch with for, you know, every week for a month or two. And it's not so impossible as you know, for a shy person like myself to stand up in front of a group of people I've never seen before. It was a little bit easier to sort of test the waters with people that I knew. And so in Rotary, you get to meet the people in your own club. You also get to meet people in other clubs, so you can use it to the extent that you want. If you wanted to stay in your own club with your own 25 or 30 people, you can do that. You can go to neighboring clubs or international clubs and build your network. So it all depends on, you know, what's important to you, but it was a really good experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk a lot about networking and the importance of establishing your own personal network. It seems that we're all so busy these days, though. I mean, it's so difficult, and there's so much communication coming, you know, through the phone or the email or whatever, and it just seems like people are are more scattered and distracted than you know, certainly a couple years ago even. Things are accelerating.
Well, that's true, but first of all, having a network has to be a priority. And you can have different networks for different purposes. You know, if you're a stay-at-home mom, you might not necessarily need, you know, a business contact, but you might need to have a network of other stay-at-home moms that if you have an emergency, you can call someone and they can take the kids while you go to the doctor or, you know, whatever. It's a priority because those are the people that are there for you when you need someone. And when you talk about being busy usually entails meeting people. Most people are not usually busy by themselves. So, you know, if you're working, you know, you have your people at work that you're busy with. If you belong to a union or an association, if you like to ride a bicycle even, you know, instead of going for a bicycle ride by yourself, maybe you can join a group of bicycle riders. And then those people become part of your network. It's sort of seeing beyond yourself, I think.
Very good.
Those are the people that are there for you when you need to solve a problem.
We're almost at our midpoint with attorney Margaret Bash talking about her book, Every Woman Should Go to Law School or Read This Book. We have one listener to include in our conversation, and we'll welcome others. 333-WILL around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I'd like to know how accessible the law library is at the University of Illinois.
Well, good question.
I can answer that question only generally as it relates to every other law library in the state of Illinois.
Well, I mean, I've never been in it because it seems it's not for me, you know. It's only for law students.
As far as I know, every law school, law library is open to the public.
Uh-huh.
They might not let you take books out if you don't work there or you're not a student there.
Right.
In terms of having access to doing legal research,
uh-huh,
not only are the law school libraries open to the public, but every courthouse has a library that's open to the public.
And do they have reference librarians?
Every library that I've ever been in has a reference librarian. Obviously, just like in every library, some of them are more helpful than others.
Uh-huh.
I do have a chapter in my book on how to use a law library.
Oh, really?
And what you're looking for. Basically, there are three important resources, case books, digests, and statute books.
Huh?
And I explain the difference and what you can find in each of them.
Huh?
I think every person should go to the law library that's near them and acquaint themselves with where all the materials are so that when you have a legal problem and you just want to look up the answer to a question, you know where to look.
Right.
I mean, the first sentence in that chapter is, ignorance of the law excuses no one.
Yeah.
But how many people know how to go to the law library?
They don't.
And look it up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an interesting chapter. And just before I forget this thought, reference librarians are the salt of the earth.
Oh, I think so, too.
In terms of the U of I Law Library, I mean, I've been there and I've checked out books there. I know you can't check out, you know, the case law books and things like that because there are references that have to remain in the building. But one of the things that you say is that people feel like the law is something they couldn't possibly understand, or they don't have law school education, and so they're intimidated by the very idea.
I think so. I think that's unfortunate. You know, there was just a Supreme Court case that came down a couple weeks ago reinforcing the Miranda idea that the police have to tell you your Miranda rights when they arrest you.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. When you were in second grade on the playground, what was the one thing about the law that every kid could recite? You have the right to remain silent. You know, if you choose not to remain silent, whatever you say can be used against you. I mean, every kid can say it because it's on every police show and every law show on television. Everybody knows that. Everybody doesn't know all the rest of the law, and yet under the law, everybody's presumed to know it. Ignorance of the law excuses no one. So to me, at a minimum, every kid, you know, in junior high or high school, or at least in college, should learn how to use a law library to do basic legal research to look up the answer to a question. I mean, how, if you can't even look it up, how can you know what your obligations are? Or if your neighbor comes and says, well, I'm going to sue you for doing this because, you know, you can't do that. Well, everybody can't hire a lawyer every time they have a question. Everybody's not Oprah with unlimited resources. And even where she has unlimited resources to hire platoons of lawyers, I still think as a non-lawyer it has to be frustrating not to be able to go yourself to the library and look up the answer to a question, to have to depend on somebody else, you know, whether they're a lawyer with 20 years' experience or a lawyer right out of school or a lawyer who's done your kind of case before or not. To me, it has to be frustrating to have to rely on somebody else to say this is what you can and can't do. I just feel like everybody should be empowered at least enough to be able to go to the library and look it up.
Well, maybe I'll ask some follow-up questions about that, but first we have another listener waiting. I want to include them.
Okay.
This is another listener in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. Actually, I'm calling to resolve that question. I work at one of the university libraries, and today I happen to be on my evening shift, so I was at home listening to your program.
Very good.
And for listeners in Illinois, anyone who is a resident of Illinois can get a library card for all the university libraries. They need to go to the main library,
203 Main Library, isn't it?
203 Main Library.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the street address, and my mind's gone blank. It's Gregory, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's during office hours. That's the office number. After hours, they can come to the circulation desk, and the supervisors there can issue them with a courtesy card. This entitles any resident of the state to use the libraries. What the actual policy in the law library itself is, I don't know. I'm sure they're very helpful. We have wonderful staff in all of our libraries, and it is one of the most superb libraries in the country. So I've got in a little plug there, and I hope disseminated some information. And
excellent.
It's a wonderful show. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the call.
Right, bye-bye.
Thank you.
And I'll second the thought. The U of I library is plain outstanding. And the law library is recently renovated and enlarged and all that, so it's a very good place.
Well, I should say, I live in Arlington Heights.
Yeah.
And even here in Arlington Heights at our local library, they have enough law reference books to do basic legal research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have the Illinois statutes, some Illinois cases, I think going back to maybe the 50s, and all the federal cases. I mean, here at our local library. And so I think people really need to investigate what resources are available to them and not just say, well, I don't know how to use a law library, and even though all my tax money is going to pay for this local law library, I'm just, you know, not going to acquaint myself with it. You paid for it. It's yours. You might as well learn how to use it.
We have another caller to include in our conversation. Let's do that. Another Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest had any suggestions for people involved in the bureaucracies, either federal, states, or local, where there are employees who, to quote one story I looked at, are so encrusted with rights and rules that they pretty much do what they want to do and cannot be fired. You know, I'm not so sure any amount of networking, for example, would help in some cases that I've personally heard about and some in others that I've read about.
Thank you for asking that question. I have a chapter in my book called Ask What Your Country and State and Village Can Do for You. And the fact is, government employees work for you. And there is some accountability. And I talk about that. I mean, one of the things you can do is obviously the name-dropping thing through your network that, you know, if you know somebody in the department who's not necessarily in the part that you need, you can drop a name. You know, I have a friend in your department that said you would help me, and that gives you some accountability. But also, you have your elected officials. And if you're trying to deal with the federal government and you're not getting the response that you want, call your congressman. They have a whole staff of people whose job it is to help you deal with the federal government. And if you have a problem at the state level, call your state representative or your state senator. I mean, that person is directly accountable to you because you can vote for them, you can tell your friends to vote for them or not vote for them, and chances are they have more experience and better contacts dealing with, you know, the Department of Revenue or whatever bureaucracy you're talking about, so that you're not just starting from scratch. I mean, you can try starting from scratch, but if you hit a wall, there are other resources available to you.
Well, I was actually thinking not so much in terms of someone coming to an agency and looking for help as much as someone in the agency, working for the agency, who has an employee or a subordinate who doesn't do her job, and yet it's impossible to fire them, that kind of thing. I don't know if going out of the bureaucracy, look to a elected official. I don't know how much power they might have to reach in. And
so you're talking about two people working for the same agency.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Oh. Where one's superior to the other, and the subordinate, maybe always talking on the phone or constantly taking advantage of their sick leave, or when they're obviously not sick, and basically a bad attitude toward the work they have to do, and yet they feel that they can't be fired. And in fact, in many cases, getting them fired is indeed very extremely extremely difficult. You know, there all of our bureaucracies, or many of them at least, are saddled with these kind of employees. And you know, I've never heard anybody really address the problem, and I don't want to burden you with the entire thing. But.
Well, what I'm thinking of, and what I'm always thinking of, is that your initial reaction should be, okay, here's the problem, and what resources are available to me? And it sounds like in that situation, the resources would have to be contained within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I can't speak to your specific problem,
but I would think that
you know, you should be able to talk to the supervisor, to your coworkers, to, if it's, you know, state of Illinois, if there's a union involved, you might be able to go to the union. I mean, there are resources, and I think what you need to do is say, okay, what can I try? And if it gets to the point where, you know, there's a conflict and you need to get out of that situation, then at least if you have a good network within the organization, maybe you can do a lateral change, if you know people in the department. So, I mean, I guess the whole point is just to always be thinking of what are the resources. And yes, I understand it can be frustrating, especially in that kind of situation, but it's not hopeless, I don't think, in any circumstance.
Well, I'm not so sure, but I'll let you go on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Employment law is an area where, I mean, yeah, I've heard of scenarios that the caller describes, and on the other hand, I've also heard of scenarios where, you know, people can basically be fired at will in other workplaces with no real reason or fault. And I would think in any of these cases, if someone is trying to deal with the situation to improve it, they need to know the law.
Illinois is an employment at will state, and an employer can fire an employee for any reason or no reason at all.
Yeah.
I don't think most people appreciate that. The exceptions to that are, if a person is being discriminated against, because there are laws to protect for that, and also if a person has a contract or an employee manual that says that certain procedures have to be followed and those procedures are not followed, because an employee manual is a contract. But I think it's important for people to know what the basic law is. I think if some people knew that it was an employment at will state, they might request a contract when they take a new job. You know, before you move across the state for another job, maybe you want to insist on having a contract so that you don't move and then find out, you know, 3 months later, it's employment at will and they decided they don't want you anymore and you're out of there.
Yeah. We have a couple calls waiting. Let's go on and include them. Next up, a listener in Effingham, I believe on a car phone, line two. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I am on a car phone, but I've pulled over to the side of the road.
Oh, good. Bless you.
I'm a very big supporter of libraries. In fact, I've served on the library board of my local community, and I believe that utilizing libraries to gain information, not to mention recreation, is vital. However, I want, as a lawyer, I want to take a little exception with what your guest has said about law libraries and about using them. For one thing, I certainly hope she's not an attorney, because she has misstated the law, a basic law about Miranda. She said that everybody knows that the police have to give you your Miranda warnings when they arrest you, and that's not true. They need to give you your Miranda warnings for custodial interrogation. Now, that's just a small point, but it illustrates a common misconception, and common misconceptions often occur when people go to law libraries and do a little bit of research. Sometimes a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous. So I would suggest a better way of saying it would be, go to your law library, do some research to either narrow or perhaps expand your area of your search, and then that'll give you a better opportunity to define the questions and comments you may have when you go see an attorney. But don't take action as a layperson based upon the research you have done in a law library. There are a number of reasons why lawyers are lawyers and have their degrees of expertise, and knowing the proper, quite difficult way we're trained to research is one of the most important.
You don't think there's any circumstance where a person can go to the law library and get a form and complete a transaction or do a living will without having to involve an attorney?
Well, there are a lot of lawyers who make a lot of money undoing problems that people have caused because they wanted to avoid spending the $200 or $300 at the outset. I'm just saying that caution is best because you just spoke of employment contracts. When a contract is signed, it becomes a contract, and you're charged with the knowledge of the document you have signed. And if it is very much against your interest, well, you're just going to have to live with that. I'm just suggesting that it's sometimes being penny-wise and pound-foolish. Do the research, narrow your focus, then speak with an attorney about how to proceed the best way to accomplish your goal. That's all I'm saying. But the very basic things. There are very basic misconceptions that the citizenry has. For example, the police must give you your Miranda warnings when they arrest you, and that's just not true.
Okay, there was just a basic. I mean, the point was everybody knows the Miranda warning.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't know all the basics of the law, and sometimes if you just want an answer to a question like, what time do parks close in Arlington Heights, you can go to the library and look it up.
What time does the park close in Arlington Heights?
Yeah, I had a client who got arrested for being in a park after 11 o'clock at night. But there's no signs posted saying the parks close at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, there are a lot of laws, little basic things that you can look up at the library without having to bother an attorney every time you have a question.
No, but if you want to know what time a park closes, you call the city or the park district.
Right, and I talk about those.
If there isn't a notice posted, how could there be an enforcement of that? But regardless, what I'm saying is that it's oftentimes best go ahead and do some research to narrow your focus and then speak with a professional. Similarly to the medical arts practice, it's a good idea to go to the web or to go to some books and try and get an idea of what these symptoms may be bringing about, but it would be foolish to commence treatment on your own based upon the research of the symptoms that you have determined. Attorneys are professionals, accountants are professionals, physicians are, and you should let the professionals accomplish those goals. You can always take an aspirin, you can always pay a parking ticket, but sometimes it's best that you do the research and then take that information you may have to an attorney to have that attorney help you in your particular problem.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
All right. We have another listener waiting on line number 4, also on a car phone. So, you know, before we tie up traffic any longer, let's talk with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Oh, I'm pulled over, too.
Okay.
I, of course, haven't read the book. I just was driving and listening to the program. But as somebody who's been through a divorce, and a very contentious divorce, and a long post-divorce and messy post-divorce process, and most of the time of represented myself in the hearings. I have noticed in observing in courtrooms and in the proceedings with friends of mine and acquaintances who have gone through divorces is that one unfortunate aspect of divorce is that the person with the most money usually wins in a divorce case. And I know so many people who have gone into, found themselves quite unwittingly in a divorce and have ended up with no financial resources to wage the war that one has to wage when one goes into court. And essentially their attorney has told them that, look, you'd better settle because you just can't afford to take this any further. And I don't know whether this is a chapter in your book or not, but I would encourage anybody to in a marriage to make sure that they have some financial resources available to them so that if they do get into this very unfortunate situation, they have a substantial retainer that they can bring to an attorney, and they're not caught in this situation that they end up having to just settle for whatever the other attorney says that they have to settle for, because it's an unfortunate reality of the courts that when you're dealing with really tragic custody problems and neglected children, that the average run-of-the-mill divorce isn't going to excite a judge very much to act in terms of real justice, but in terms of what the attorneys are really wanting to do.
Hmm. Well, Ms. Besh, what do you think?
I agree with everything you just said. The legal system is outrageously expensive for the participants in it. And divorce is one of those situations that it's really out of hand and can get especially out of hand for individuals involved in it. And I've had, you know, my own personal friends and acquaintances go through that same thing.
Everybody likes to think it's never going to happen to them, but unfortunately it does, and it's usually the woman that gets the short end of it.
Well, and I talked about, you know, I have a chapter in my book on resources, that people shouldn't just assume that they don't have access to legal help. There are resources, obviously, for battered women, for elderly people, for people who make under the poverty level who need an attorney. There are, you know, poverty law centers even, and attorneys like me who volunteer to do some cases on a pro bono basis every year. But for middle-class people, there are not a lot of legal...
Yeah, that's the point. The middle-class people, it's the woman who has lived in a comfortable house, maybe not working, has the luxury of being a mother and being at home with the children, and all of a sudden she's hit with this divorce, and... she has no money, the money is in her husband's name, and she's out of luck.
I absolutely agree with that. I talked about it in my book, that there need to be more resources for things like divorces, because nobody I know can do their own divorce.
Yeah.
Even an attorney would be not too brilliant to do their own divorce, even if they're a divorce attorney or just too personally involved in it.
Out of personal experience, attorneys often aren't that good at it either.
Well, and I agree with that. I mean, I hate to say it, but when I try to find a really good divorce attorney for a friend that doesn't charge everything they own, it's hard even for me, and I have resources.
Yeah.
And the most unfortunate thing about it is that children's lives are at stake.
Right.
You know, are you just going to award custody to the person who has the better legal resource or, you know, more money available? That doesn't seem like it's in the best interest of the children. But if one person's not, you know, in a position to fight that, absolutely, it's not fair. I agree. The book isn't about how wonderful the system is.
Right. Anyway, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We have just about 3 minutes left. One, you know, speaking of lawyers, hiring lawyers, especially in divorce situations, I have seen too many situations where, you know, a couple is going through a divorce, whether it's both parties or maybe one who wants out of the marriage, they come to some sort of understanding about what's going to happen, and then they hire an attorney. One of them hires an attorney, and suddenly that understanding changes dramatically. And perhaps what was going to be joint custody, all of a sudden the lawyer is telling one of the other parties that you have to, you shouldn't agree to that. You need to, demand sole custody, and you need to demand the house and all this stuff. And suddenly what was an amicable or somewhat amicable split turns into a nasty court fight.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been seeing it just recently, people coming to me saying, oh, my husband and I agreed on everything. Can you just recommend a lawyer who can go into court and file the papers for us?
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, are you really sure this is uncontested? Because sometimes there are issues people haven't considered, which is part of why you hire a lawyer. And then once they get a lawyer, it's not uncontested anymore. And instead of a $650 uncontested legal fee, now it's in the thousands, and they can't necessarily afford it again.
Well, how do you go about determining whether you're getting good lawyering? I mean, if that's appropriate, I mean, there's some general guidelines in terms of hiring an attorney or,
Yeah, part of it is don't ever pick your lawyer out of the phone book except as a last resource, and don't necessarily rely on a bar association referral, because basically those work the same way as the Yellow Pages. I don't think most people know that, but to get listed with a bar association, you pay the bar association a fee to recommend you. The best way to hire a lawyer is to get a referral. If you know a lawyer who's not necessarily a divorce lawyer and you need a divorce, call your lawyer and say, I need a divorce. Can you recommend someone? And chances are they, will know somebody. If you don't know a lawyer but you know an accountant, ask your accountant. If you don't know another professional, ask somebody that you know who went through a divorce. Were you happy with your lawyer? Sometimes they'll tell you they wish they had hired their spouse's lawyer, and maybe you can call that person. And interview the lawyers before you hire them. Ask the questions, and don't ever forget that the lawyer works for the client and not the other way around. The client's the boss, and the lawyer is the employee, and the client sets the rules.
Well, we're here at the end of our time, so we're going to have to stop, and there's much more in the book than we've had time to discuss, as it seems to always be the case on the show. The hour goes pretty quickly, and I also apologize to one last caller that we weren't able to include in the conversation, but I can suggest if you'd like to read more, you can look for the book we've been discussing, Every Woman Should Go to Law School, or read this book, recently published in paper by HarperCollins, and the author has been our guest, Margaret Bash, and her last name is spelled B-A-S-C-H. And thanks a lot for talking with us, Margaret. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Jack.
Appreciate your time.
Thanks. Bye-bye.